You know, Australians have so many questions about coronavirus, and sometimes not even Dr. Norman Swan knows how to answer them. We're talking about the big questions like, what is Australia's strategy for coronavirus, and where and why there's different policies for different schools in different states? So to try and get some answers, the CoronaCast podcast invited one of the people who is advising the federal government on how to navigate the pandemic to join them here on today's episode.
Hello, this is CoronaCast, a podcast all about the coronavirus. I'm health reporter Tegan Taylor.
And I'm physician and journalist Dr. Norman Swan. It's Wednesday, the 22nd of April.
So as promised, we have with us today Deputy Chief Medical Officer Paul Kelly. We've been asking for your questions that you want us to put to him, and we're going to try to get through as many as we can today. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Oh, you're welcome.
So Tony's asking about masks. He's wondering why the federal government is still not recommending masks for everyone who goes out in public. And also he's asking why the federal government isn't supporting the state's actions on school closures.
Firstly, on masks, we look at the evidence as well and as quickly as we can that emerges in relation to masks. And as people would know, and I think Norman's mentioned it on this program in recent days in the US, the Centers for Disease Control have recommended mask use in public, certainly in the US situation and their epidemiology with way more cases in the general community. Perhaps that makes sense. But for us, firstly, very few cases. Secondly, masks are not great protection if you don't know how to wear them. Masks that are not made in the prescribed way will not be effective in our view in relation to stopping the spread of the virus or indeed protecting others. So that's the reason we haven't recommended masks at the moment. In previous times, there was a shortage, of course, and we were wanting masks to remain for our frontline health workers. That's been relieved in recent times with an increase in supply. So that's no longer a reason.
So Paul, just on masks for a moment, I mean, people recognise that this is about asymptomatic spread. So if you've got it and you don't know it, it might reduce the spread. How bad would the epidemic have to get in Australia for the small benefit to be worth it, do you think, in masks if you had the resources, if there were enough masks around?
A lot worse than what it is now, Norman, I think would be the short answer. And as an epidemiologist, of course, I would always say it depends. But certainly, if there was widespread community transmission, it could at that point be reviewed. But at the moment, we don't believe it's the right way.
And what about Tony's second question, the one on school closures and the state's actions here?
Yeah, so school closures is an interesting one. Certainly the Australian Health Protection Committee has been very clear from the beginning in our advice to the National Cabinet, but the National Cabinet was made up of 9 different states and different states have to make their own decisions. They're the elected governments and they're the ones that run the school system. So some have gone further than others. So in the NT, for example, they haven't closed schools, the same in South Australia. In other places, they've directly and specifically asked kids to stay at home. In New South Wales, it's somewhere in between. They're suggesting that children should start coming back one day a week. I think there's a couple of issues here. Firstly, in our current situation, not a lot of transmission in society, and so that would be the same in schools. We know that transmission amongst children is not strong, and children themselves do not get severe illness. We know that pretty strongly now, including in Australian data and Australian investigations of outbreaks. There is the question, of course, and a very valid question about teachers and their safety, and all of the outbreaks we've looked at has tended to start with a teacher or a parent and spread amongst teachers. So the staff room is actually the most dangerous place rather than the schoolroom or the schoolyard in terms of teachers.
So Kelly asks on schools, why are we reopening schools when social distance is so important? And I suppose the add-on to Kelly's question I'd ask is, well, how do you socially distance when you've got 14-year-olds in the playground?
Very difficult, and I understand that. My sister, in fact, two of my sisters are teachers, one of them currently working as the schools come back in New South Wales. So, of course, these things are challenging, and I think the point is you can do as best you can in terms of social distancing. There's certainly a lot you can do about hygiene around the school.
Why can kids go to school but they're not allowed to play on public playgrounds?
Yeah, well, that's a challenge. Some of these things, I can certainly see how it's difficult to maintain those two conflicting pieces of advice. I'd say this, though, at least in schools, we do know who's on the school playground, and there is some ability within the school environment to increase those hygiene messages and cleaning, for example. Public playgrounds are a bit less of a controlled environment, more open to others coming in. So I think that's part of it. But look, I think as we go forward, we've been so successful in dampening down the curve, flattening the curve, and so few cases that in the next month we'll be seeing the relaxation of many of those things that have been introduced.
So we've got some questions on strategy and eradication. I might just roll up the three questions and just tell you what they are because they overlap. Margaret asks, could we eradicate COVID-19 from our shores? And she says, if so, why aren't we apparently not doing so? Hendrik asks, why is the federal government not moving towards a COVID-19 elimination strategy? And Luciana asks, why would we even consider stopping the current measures for diminishing the spread of the virus before complete eradication? So three questions on the theme.
Yeah, so the theme of our strategy. So that was made much more explicit last week by the Prime Minister and the Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, which just outlines what we have indeed been doing all along, but making it more explicit, and that's about a suppression strategy. So that's in between the let it rip or herd immunity strategy that some countries are going along, which if you do that, you end up with a lot of infections, and some of those will be severe, about 20% of them, and people will die. And so that is not a strategy that we're looking for. Right at the other end is, of course, lock everything down and look for eradication. That's New Zealand's strategy. Now, New Zealand, quite interestingly, it has announced they're starting to pull back from that lockdown phase, and they'll be much closer to where we are in terms of handling this virus more into the future. We've ended up in the same place, interestingly, and we've had more cases than New Zealand, but not a lot more. And in the recent week, very few cases, and virtually none yesterday outside of Tasmania and New South Wales. So I think we're getting to a similar place through that suppression strategy. I think, is it possible to actually eradicate this virus altogether from Australia? It might be. Certainly eliminating it as a public health problem appears to be where we're heading at the moment with our suppression strategy.
So just to interrupt, how long would you wait before you're fairly sure? In other words, you talk about, sorry to get technical, the reproductive cycles of the virus. So let's say, you know, New South Wales is the challenge here because they've had more cases than any other state. They are working hard at it, doing a lot of testing. So this is not a criticism of New South Wales, but it is the challenge. But let's assume we get down to zero in all states. How many days in a row before you think, we're actually in a pretty good shape here and we can let the break off, albeit slowly, but we can let the break off?
That's what I call a crystal ball question, Norman, and that's always a difficult one.
But no, it's a biological question, isn't it? Because you've got reproductive cycles of the virus, and once you wash through for a couple of weeks, surely you can be pretty sure.
Yeah, you would be sure, but it depends then on how certain are you that people are coming to get the testing, the so-called passive surveillance strategy, which is what we've had at the moment, and most countries that have been far worse affected than us in Europe and North America and so many other countries now. That passive surveillance depends on people coming, recognising that they're sick with the virus and getting the right test, and that test proving positive and flowing on there to public health action. What our challenge now is, okay, that seems to be drying up, but there may be other people in the communities just slowly brewing small outbreaks. We've seen that exactly playing out in northwestern Tasmania, where Tasmania pulled up the drawbridge and they went along that strategy of isolation. But then several weeks later, at some point, there was someone that had the virus, which led to other people having the virus, and now they have 80. So things can change rather quickly. And it brings us to our border controls too. At the moment, the borders are essentially shut, although there are Australians continuing to come home. We will continue to get a trickle of cases. Only needs a few of those to get out into the community. So I think declaring this over is going to be a very difficult thing to do. But I think the other side is balancing up the other effects of locking down as we've done and decreasing business and social interactions and all of the other things we need for our own well-being as well as that of the economy.
So I'm going to take the privilege of being co-host and ask my own question here, Paul Kelly. given that it's possible that, as you say, you get a few cases trickling through, and as I keep on saying, there was, you know, at one point at the end of November, there was just one person in the whole wide world with what would come to be known as COVID-19, and look where we are now with well over 2 million cases and well over 100,000 deaths. And we could get a second wave. So this question is relevant because we could come to a second wave in Australia, which might be worse than the first. Looking back, and it's only 4.5 months, what, if anything, would you do differently if it hit you again? And I'm not talking about the second wave. I'm talking about, let's go back in time, and what would you do differently?
I remember very clearly the first time I heard about this virus. So there was, as you say, probably sometime in November, there was something happening in Hubei province. We weren't absolutely clear about that. In fact, there was no sort of external reports about that until the 1st of January was actually the time when we were first notified through our World Health Organization contacts of 43 cases of an unusual pneumonia happening in Wuhan. We looked very closely at that and decided that this was something we should keep a close eye on. So we immediately had a meeting about that to decide what we should do. And we put some information out to the states and territories and through them a kind of a alert, not alarmed message to our emergency department. So we were onto this very quickly. By mid-January, we decided that things hadn't really changed much in China, at least officially. And then all hell broke loose, as we know from reports that came out of Wuhan and then rapidly other parts of China.
Just to interrupt, so you're giving yourself 10 out of 10 here or what?
I think if we'd known a bit more quickly about what was happening in China, then that might have changed some things. But on the 21st of January, we'd already realised that this actually had some was a disease of pandemic potential, and we moved to a higher alert level at that point. So the question is whether we could or should have done things more quickly. I think after that, on the 1st of February, we got modelling that demonstrated that China was possibly, the rest of China was heading towards being the same as Wuhan. And on that same day was when we put in the restrictions about people coming from China other than Australian citizens and residents. So, and things escalated quickly like that. And through March in particular, things moved very rapidly. Could we have gone a bit more quickly? Perhaps. But at the end of the day, we're in such a good situation now. It's hard to see where we could have done other things. But you know, we learn from these things. These are the best exercises we can do to test our preparedness and our reaction to these things. And so we will be more prepared for a second wave if it comes, because we've gone through a first wave.
Professor Paul Kelly, thank you very much for joining us on CoronaCast.
You're welcome, Norman.
That's all for CoronaCast today. If you've got a comment or a question, send it in. Go to abc.net.au/coronavirus and fill in the form, and make sure you use the word CoronaCast so that we can find it.
We'll see you tomorrow.
Bye.
Online health reporter Tegan Taylor with Dr. Norman Swan, talking there about corona and the virus on their podcast, CoronaCast. And you can find that on the ABC Listen app or wherever you like to get your podcasts.